Hello, this is Keith Pannell, and I'm welcoming you back to another Science Studio program. We're still at the University of Vermont, and this particular program, we're going to be talking about what I will generalize as sort of materials science. And the guest today is Professor Madalena Furis. She's a professor of physics, but very active in materials, photonic materials. But Madalena, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's going to be a great pleasure. We always like to find out a little bit about the guest that's not in the biographies, that it's not the written part. But how on earth did you become a scientist?
Well, I didn't want to be an engineer.
Okay. Well, that's
so
fine.
Let me tell you what that means. Both my parents were engineers. My father, quite a good one. His legacy will probably live for a long time in my native country. He was a civil engineer. My mother, a civil engineer also. And, you know, I grew up in communist times in Romania when an engineering career would be a solid one. So if you were good at math and physics and so on, that would be a good choice for you. You would have a chance to do something good for society and not necessarily have to be implicated politically. And then, you know, the Romanian school system had a way of identifying talent for math and sciences very early on. And so if you combine that with my own parents' background, it was clear that very early on that that's it. Madalena was going to follow a technical career. And then, you know, I've sort of chosen physics as opposed to, let's say, civil engineering. That was my father's career, because I felt like engineers did not learn enough about the fundamentals of science, you know, that were the foundations of what they were doing. And that drove me to physics.
Tell me, you said your father's legacy is going to continue for a long time.
Yes.
What was he, buildings or bridges or
road
systems?
Well, actually, most of his career he did wastewater treatment plants, but he was a structural engineer. So there's different type of civil engineers with different type of backgrounds that are involved in designing a wastewater treatment plant of large sizes in particular. The structural engineers design the special objects that make part of that. And he is the designer behind the wastewater treatment plant that was built in Bucharest in the 1980s. It started being built and then kind of, you know, was left to rot because of the political situation at the time.
I've seen a lot of things like that.
But I don't know if we have the time, but there's a fascinating story about him and those objects that can be seen, you know, on Google Earth if you go. There's some very interesting fermentation tanks that look like paraboloids.
All right. So, well, if we get to the end of the program, we might come back and revisit.
Yeah, yeah.
So you didn't want to be an engineer. You thought then physics was the way to go. You got your degree from the University
of Bucharest, yes, right. Both a BS and then an MS.
Right. And
it
then
was a recent degree.
Crossed the Atlantic.
And then I crossed the Atlantic and landed on the exact same parallel, the 45th parallel. I've lived most of my life on the 45th parallel. I still am there
right now. Right.
So both Bucharest, Buffalo, and Burlington are on the 45th parallel.
And they all begin with a B.
Yes, gosh, that's right.
Too much to take
in.
So physics, what did you do in physics as a graduate student? That's
physics,
what you chose?
Yes, physics.
What did you do as a graduate student?
As a graduate student, I was one of the most interdisciplinary and mobile students that you'll ever see. I started off working in looking at something called excitons, which meant
exciting.
Yes, it is. So basically, excitons are these, you know, strange creatures that live inside our materials that actually are responsible for the light emitted by our devices.
I mean, you could also say they're figments of our imagination.
In some sense, they're called quasi-particles, of course. So
right.
The way we understand materials in general is a material is like a playground for all these imaginary particles that essentially describe different interactions between electrons in materials. And so some of these interactions are actually responsible for the light that we see coming out of, you know, light-emitting diodes that are everywhere nowadays, from our flashlights that we buy at Home Depot to our LED screens.
Right.
So there's many different materials that emit light in that way, and even though they're all called semiconductors for the most part, it turns out that the emission mechanisms and the physics behind these quasi-particles is quite different. And so my graduate school days has been a journey through different type of such electronic materials that emit light. And that took me from, you know, a classic condensed matter physics lab where people used all sorts of fancy lasers and lenses and a lot of expensive equipment to probe and understand this interaction of light and matter, to an electrical engineering lab, because turns out that the interest in a particular type of materials called gallium nitride was mostly the turf of electrical engineers at the time. And so I wanted to work on those, and I ended up having an advisor who was an electrical engineer, but was doing the same type of research that one would do to study those materials as a physicist. That's interesting, isn't it?
Well, no, it is. It's how careers develop, though.
Yes,
I mean, it's and especially to your total credit, I mean, this is extraordinarily interdisciplinary. And a lot of people now pay obeisance to the concept of interdisciplinary. But it usually means getting people from different disciplines to work together.
Yes.
Whereas your case, you're sort of straddling a couple of areas in your own expertise.
Yes. And, you know, for me, it wasn't such a big change because the methods we were using and the concepts we were working with and the things we were after were really, truly, as far as I was concerned, fundamental. And, you know, that's why a few years later, or 10 years, fast forward 10, 15 years later, and Shiji Nakamura, whose books I was reading at the time when I was in grad school, got the Nobel Prize for physics, right? And it's interesting that, I mean, Nakamura himself says that he's kind of upset that he got it for actually making the blue laser diode and not for the fundamental physics phenomenon that he discovered that, you know, he was able to understand and harness that led to the blue laser diode.
No, that's it. I mean, physics nowadays, modern physics, is so difficult to talk about because it's beyond most people's understanding. You've already used and threw out so easily the word quasi-particle.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a scientist.
Yes.
And yet I still have complications getting around those ideas.
Yes.
And so, you know, one of the things that we teach our students is that scientists have got to become more capable of talking to the lay public about what they do. Because if we leave the public too far behind, the public will forget we're there, and then funding will go away, and then progress in that area will go away.
Yeah.
Now, do you have a simple way of explaining to your grandmother and to Keith what the hell is a quasi-particle?
Right.
We'll start
so
there.
So the main reason behind the fact that condensed matter physics, which is, you know, arguably the largest part of physics today in terms of effort, funding, and number of people working in the field, is so opaque to the general public is, as one of my colleagues put it, the reciprocal space. And I'll explain in a second what that means. So in a material, you're dealing with very complex interaction between many, many particles. People have often heard, I think, about Avogadro's number. We've learned about it, right? It's the number of molecules or atoms you have in one mole of a substance, right? So you always have to think that you have this huge number of electrons interacting with each other in very complicated ways, right? So we need to somehow model that interaction in order to understand it. Or how do we think about it? Brute force doesn't work. Trying to imagine or, you know, write this many equations of motion for every single electron is not going to take us anywhere. But if we think of these interactions as somehow modifying or changing the overall mass of these particles, right? So we're thinking of interaction as mass.
Right, right? Because E is equal to mc squared.
Then through a rather complicated but well-established mathematical process, we can actually imagine all of these electrons as being a gas of non-interacting particles. But these particles, while they may retain or not some of the characteristics of our original electrons, they're not the same. They have different mass. And like I say, the mass is actually a measure of these complicated interactions that the electrons have in the solid. And so when I talk about these excitonic quasi-particles, they're just like electrons dressed with some interactions, and now I can think of them as a gas of non-interacting particles, which, you know, some of us learn about maybe even in high school on how to think about them, right? How to calculate the velocity of a molecule in a non-interacting gas. This is a much easier system to deal with than the complex interactions between individual electrons. And so basically your material is viewed as a playground for non-interacting molecules or entities or quasi-particles at some point.
And, and all these quasi-particles playing around there need someone to think about them and direct them and utilize their,
yes,
their playful activity.
And then at some point, of course, you know, our approximations are not sufficient, and then quasi-particles themselves start interacting. And that creates
another
quasi-particle and right, so on, yeah, right? So it sounds complicated, but once again,
the end result of that is that quasi-particles are a simplification of reality, whatever that is. But it's one that we can handle.
Yes, and it's a model good enough to explain, you know, a quasi-particle becomes sort of obsolete the moment that it can no longer explain the observed phenomena. And then we need to think further on modeling these interactions in a more sophisticated way.
And in a sense, that's built in to
into the model.
Right? So you know that this model is going to be a temporary fix, if you like.
Yes, exactly.
And then, so in your particular expertise, are you utilizing beyond the quasi-particles that you're dealing with now to the next level? Or are you saying,
yes,
look, we've got a model. It seems to work quite nicely with a certain sphere of materials. These are materials that are interesting, and I'm going to look for more material usage, or are you wanting to go to the next level already?
As a physicist, I always want to go to the next level. But of course, I'm an experimentalist, right? Which means that often I'm not thinking of a model first necessarily, but rather I'm thinking of an interesting experiment that we could do. And then we realize that what we observe experimentally, specifically looking at these excitons, for example, or this quasi-particle, cannot necessarily be explained with established models. And then I try to think, okay, what kind of interactions or, you know, what kind of changes we could do to this model or that could explain what's going on.
Plenty of room for creative thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And then I usually go to a theorist and seek help.
We'll take a quick break here, Madalena. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm talking with Madalena Furis, Professor of Physics, originally from Bucharest, through Buffalo to Burlington, all the Bs, on the 45th parallel. And that sounds like it should be a story, working on the 45th parallel. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Is it really a question as to who's the boss in the 74 million American homes where a cat dwells? Not in my house.
Overall, we've had quite a long relationship with cats, over 8,000 years of living together. So what led to the domestication of cats, even though many would argue they never were?
A recent study reveals the domestication of cats is a far different story than the one with dogs. Far earlier than cats, dogs were bred to provide specific services such as hunting, whereas cats essentially backed their way into human life.
Recent genetic studies involving more than 200 cat remains, some as far back as more than 8,000 years ago, reveal cats interacted with humans in the Tigris Valley in modern-day Iraq. A second wave of people and cats living together was initiated in Egypt around 4400 BCE.
Both these periods involved farming, and with that, a need to store food. And this is how cats and farmers developed a symbiotic relationship, where cats could keep the rodent numbers low and farmers welcomed them.
To understand whether this was an intentional domestication by humans, scientists looked for genetic changes in cats from that time, but found no major differences between the wild and farm residents.
This means the relationship was merely mutual at the time. But by the Middle Ages, cats were being domesticated, selected for use on ships to protect food supplies and on inland trade routes.
Genetic evidence shows people bred cats for certain traits, and fancy breeding also began. Even so, while cats enjoy our companionship, we know even after all this time, it's the fuzzy tails that are in charge.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Professor Madalena Furis from the Department of Physics at the University of Vermont. And Madalena, you just made it very clear that you are, in fact, an experimentalist.
Yes.
So the quasi-particles, you know, they've come around because theoreticians have sort of sought to explain interactions between electrons that
yes.
are very complicated that we didn't quite know how to handle, hence the theories. But you're an experimentalist.
Yes.
Tell us, what are the experiments that you do?
Yes.
Because I'm an experimentalist, and, you know,
yes.
if I need understanding what I'm doing, I have to go to a theoretician, and I have to believe what they say, only if they give me the result that I know I've experimentally
Absolutely.
Found.
Yes.
So what experiments do you do?
So I essentially probe electrons with light, meaning that a lot of these quasi-particles have a specific signature in what we call optical spectroscopy experiments. That means, in essence, that we shine some light, often a laser beam, onto the material. These quasi-particles are formed as a result of absorbing that light or the photons. And then,
or just energy.
Just
That'll
energy,
do,
yes.
Right.
And then that excess energy gained is in turn, at some point, released in the form of light. So that's called photoluminescence.
Right.
That's the main mechanism behind your LED screen, for example. That's why the light-emitting diodes light up, because of this photoluminescence that they release.
And phosphorescence and fluorescence
are two specific types of photoluminescence.
Where you irradiate at one length wavelength and emit at a different, but always of lower energy, usually.
Usually of lower energy,
right.
That's correct. And then you can analyze these luminescence using detectors and spectrometers, so you can quantify the luminescence,
mm-hmm.
how intense it is, what are the colors. Usually this luminescence is not a single energy or color, right?
Yeah.
So in spectroscopy, energy is color, wavelength is color, right, for the general public. And so you have many colors, perhaps, which is, you know, you have a certain spectrum associated with your luminescence, and all of that are specific signatures of these quasi-particles.
And so then you were saying very early on that you've got this particular interest in two elements, one of which is very familiar to people, nitrogen, and the other is gallium.
Yes.
And when you put them together, you get gallium nitride,
Correct.
GaN.
Yes.
And what's so special about GaN compared to ALN, aluminium nitride, or indium nitride? what's gallium doing here?
Well, I mean, what indium, aluminum, and gallium do is they essentially tune these absorption energies of the material and the emission. So one of the ways that we can tune the colors of these materials is by, one, changing this cation, we call it, the metal, right?
Right, yes.
And so we can tune the energy that way. And sometimes we can even alloy these materials, like make indium gallium nitride. So replace some of the gallium with indium. That's you know, nowadays fairly easy to do. And then you tune the color even further. If you make an LED display, you'll need a range of colors.
Yes.
And they all need to be fabricated of the same material because they all need to be on the same chip. Technologically, you cannot just put a gallium nitride LED next to a gallium arsenide LED, for example, which emits in the red, and say, oh, I've made a display panel. No, you have to have the same material all the way through.
And in fact, that goes down to the whole concept of manufacturing and engineering.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
I mean, the science is the one thing.
Yes.
But it's got to be engineers and people who know how to fabricate that really make the material in the end.
So sometimes, you know, problems, interesting fundamental research problems can spring out of, you know, a real need that we have, right? And it turns out that the physics of tuning these colors of emission is fascinating, mm-hmm. right? But at the same time, the need or the thought of what about could we tune these colors, right? That thought comes out of a technological practical need.
Right.
We really need to do that in order to create an LED display.
How do someone like yourself looking at these optical properties, and presumably you're doing this game of taking the gallium nitride but
yes.
putting small amounts of other elemental materials in there.
Yeah.
You have research students, obviously.
Yes.
Fabricating these materials?
Well, usually the materials are fabricated by collaborators.
Okay.
Because I'm more of a person who probes these materials and characterizes their electronic properties.
So we've got a hierarchy there,
the
people, the physicists, the theoreticians that think they understand these quasi-particles. You've then got sometimes they're chemists who can actually manufacture and deposit thin films of these materials.
That's right.
And then they pass it on to you. So this is a trinity, right,
of
activity.
Well, there's actually a fourth leg on this.
The fourth dimension is the device
physicist.
Tell us.
So once you have these materials made, right, and characterized in the fashion that I told you about, you have to have somebody who knows how to take this, what we call the thin films, the material itself, and actually make a working light-emitting diode, for example, or a transistor. And there's a lot of physics that happens, you know, at the interface between a metal contact and one of these emitters.
Ah, right.
So you could have a beautiful emitter that's completely dark if you don't know the art and science of making devices. So I would say that my materials feedback loop has four legs always, four stops in the loop.
When you do this then, your scientific communication to your peers, these will be one by the physicist, do you publish as a team?
So you try very much to publish as a team because it's really a team effort if all aspects of these are met. Sometimes you don't need to fabricate a device in order to publish. Obviously, you know, looking at some of the experimental characterization of the thin films is sufficient. Other times the theory already exists in published papers, and then you don't need a theorist on board. You can cite the existing literature. But most of the times, it's usually a team of at least two different groups with two different expertise, right?
Or so sets in fact, of skills. Someone in your position, you can collaborate up and you can collaborate down.
Yes,
and by
that's right.
Down, I don't mean to be pejorative.
The device person
will interact strongly with you, much more so than he would or she would interact with the theoretician at the beginning, probably.
I don't know if it's a rule. There's a lot of theorists that are involved in understanding what happens, as I mentioned, in a device at the interface between a metal contact and the emitting layer, for example.
Right.
So, you know, then a device physicist would interact closely with a theorist directly.
Well, we've just got a few minutes left, Madalena.
Yeah.
What are your goals? I mean, do you have a particular vision of a particular new material? Or are you trying to tweak current materials to give you results and interactions you would like to see?
So right now, I've moved in a, what some would call a completely new direction compared to my grad school days and the nitride semiconductors I mentioned. But I think it's the same problem. I'm actually looking at the same fascinating excitonic phenomena, but in an entirely different group of materials that are called organic semiconductors.
Ah.
And even though the word semiconductor is in there, electrons and this quasi-particle behave in a completely different way in organic systems than they would in silicon or gallium nitride.
And do you understand why?
Well, that's the fascinating part is that we're at a level where we're excited about what we're observing in experiments. We start observing in experiments, and there's a lot more to be done to understand and basically harness these quasi-particles.
Tell me what sort of organic materials that you could name.
Yes, they're called small molecules in general. Specifically, now I'm looking at phthalocyanins because they are very popular, well-studied as molecules. But it turns out that once they crystallize in a thin film that we could use in devices, what we call long-range interactions, these are the complicated interactions, intermolecular interactions that I mentioned earlier.
These are two-dimensional films. The interaction is they lie one upon the other.
These are crystalline films that are in essence three-dimensional.
Right.
However, because of the special way that the molecules arrange in these films, they're called a one-dimensional system, or chemists call them J aggregates. Molecules are flat and sort of disc-like shaped, and they stack like dishes in a dish rack.
Okay.
That's the best analogy that I can make. And it turns out that this dish rack-like organization creates very interesting long-range phenomena along that dish rack.
Along the axis, right?
And
that's very interesting.
It turns out that we're this quasi-particle called excitons that we thought, chemists thought they knew everything about them in single molecules. Condensed matter physicists, they thought they learned everything about them in systems like gallium nitride or gallium arsenide or silicon in your computers. No secrets to
them. And they were both wrong.
And now they're both wrong.
Right.
And what's more interesting is they really need to come together because these materials exhibit properties that are basically reminiscent of both systems. Sometimes they behave molecules, sometimes they behave like semiconductors.
Materials.
yes.
Well, we've come to the end. I mean, the time always goes so fast in these discussions and conversations. But the idea would be then that the organic materials will start to not necessarily replace, but become much more common in the market, for example.
Yes. Okay. And the news is that this new phenomena are going to move the organics from their traditional role as possible photovoltaic materials to something even more fascinating and a little bit more into the future, flexible electronics.
There we leave it. Flexible electronics.
Yes.
It'll be on our clothes. It'll be anywhere that we need to have flexibility, and that's almost everywhere. 28 minutes of really interesting conversation, and I thank you very much for being here.
No, my pleasure.
Welcome from Bucharest to Buffalo and now Burlington, Vermont. I'd like to thank Professor Madalena Furis from the University of Vermont. And I also want to thank, of course, Lauren Terrasas for editing the program. And finally, I'd like to thank you for being out there and listening. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio and another one from the University of Vermont, in fact. Adios.